Hello and welcome. This is Your Call, and I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in today for Rose Aguilar. Every day, more than 140 people are estimated to die from drug overdoses in the U.S., and about two-thirds of those, about 66% of those drug overdose deaths, are linked directly to opioids. To tackle the growing health crisis here in the Bay Area, the city government has formed a Safe Injection Services Task Force, and the state of California has just passed a bill that would make it the first state in the nation to permit illegal drug use in safe, supervised spaces. They're taking a note from the city of Vancouver. Vancouver began tackling its drug problem way ahead of other places, but it's a very controversial approach. In 2003, Vancouver became the first city in North America to open those safe injection sites. They're called InSites. Now, San Francisco, with its 22,000 intravenous drug users, is considering following suit. According to the British Columbia Coroner Services, in that area last year, over 900 people died from drug overdoses, and that prompted the BC government to declare a public health emergency. That made it the first province in Canada to take a step like that. The entire province, actually, is devastated by the crisis, but Vancouver in particular has been in the center of it all, with a reported 219 overdose deaths last year. That's the highest total for any city in BC. Vancouver has tried to come up with some comprehensive models in an attempt to tackle their growing drug addiction problem. Those approaches include safe injection sites, even prescription heroin that's administered at the sites, specialized paramedics who are there, mobile medical hospitals, even injection tents, pop-up tents where volunteers actually supervise people who are injecting. So what can we learn here in San Francisco and across the country, for that matter, from Vancouver in tackling the growing drug addiction crisis right here? And how did Vancouver manage to develop the city's harm reduction model? We're going to explore those issues today on Your Call. And we're joined from Vancouver first by Sarah Blythe. Sarah is a community organizer, and she's the founder of the Overdose Prevention Society. That's a grassroots response to the drug epidemic, and it's providing pop injection sites and overdose prevention services in Vancouver. Before founding the Overdose Prevention Society, Sarah was a Vancouver Park Commissioner, and she's also worked as a mental health advocate. Sarah, so glad that you're here, especially...
Hi.
You spent time in San Francisco. Your insights are particularly valuable. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, I used to live on Lower Haight Street.
So you've got some insights that we can...
In the 90s.
We can relate to. Thanks so much. We're so glad you're here. From Vancouver, we're joined by Dr. Keith Ahmed. He's a family physician and addiction medical clinician at St. Paul's Hospital and the British Columbia Center on Substance Use. He led Vancouver's Mobile Medical Unit Opioid Response Center that provided medical emergency services in Vancouver's downtown east side. That's where a great many of the area's opioid-addicted folks were gathering. In addition to his experience providing frontline medical care, Dr. Ahmed has also been the lead on several clinical trials that studied substance use treatments and health interventions specifically for opioid addiction. And we're so glad that you could join us, Dr. Keith Ahmed. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Yes, indeed. It's a timely conversation, and we, of course, want our listeners to call in. What do you think about Vancouver's approach? And do you know someone suffering from addiction? And do you know of any services that have helped? We hope to cover all of that ground today. Sarah, I want to start with you. If you would, can you paint a picture of the east side in Vancouver? We all know it to be such a beautiful place, but there's an area of Vancouver where the opioid crisis really was like ground zero. So what was it like before some of the recent interventional steps were taken?
So I've worked in the downtown east side for over 10 years now, and I also managed a homeless shelter. We had a homeless crisis when I first started working there, and we were able to get we opened up a shelter that was low barrier or no barrier, so you could come drunk or high on drugs or whatever, and with your shopping cart and your snake, whatever, and we would, you know, take people as is and then try and help them. So I've had that experience over the years, and then I worked in mental health. I worked at Insight, the first safe injection site. I worked at various social housing buildings, and then I just got a job working for the Street Market Society, which is a market 7 days a week where people from the downtown east side, they recycle goods, they get their stuff from the food banks and trade and sort of buy, sell, and trade. To make a bit of extra money because of obviously it's very expensive to live here and welfare doesn't give very much, so people are living in very extreme poverty.
Well, that sounds very familiar once again. Yeah, San Francisco, once again, that's a tremendous parallel, yes? And so
yeah.
There are about anywhere from, 6,000 to 8,000 people in the course of a day who come to that area of the east side of Vancouver and who are addicted and who are looking for some intervention. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of social housing right in one area and a lot of services and right in one area. So it's a place for people. And it is a nice, really nice community in a lot of ways. I find it a very comforting community where people are really friendly with each other. And, you know, it's not what people necessarily think. It's a great community. Although what had happened was when we were starting to work at the market, or when I started to work at the market, we realized that there was more and more overdoses happening right in the street, one or two a day. And the street market employees, we got them to get Narcan training, and eventually it was just so many times a day that people were overdosing in the street and in the back alley, and people were dying in the alleys. And at the alley that our market is right behind our market, was people were actually dying in that alley. So we had to do something. So we basically opened our gate, put up a tent, and said, okay, you know, if you need someone to watch you use, then we're going to do that. Because it really can take minutes to save someone's life. And now, you know, 6 months later or half a year later, we are saving many people every day, and we see up to 700 people a day at our site.
And you're saying that people were literally dying. There were literally bodies in the streets every day.
Yeah. Yeah, they were literally dying, and mostly what we would say to people is don't use at home alone because that's where people would die. So we would say just come out in the street and use, and at least someone hopefully will find you, because that was really, you know, Insight was packed to, you know, filled with people, and there was nowhere else for people to go. So people would come to our market because that's where they hang out, mm-hmm. and they'd be overdosing. And so, you know, we're running the street market for people, just an outdoor market, and people are overdosing all around us. So we spent a lot of our time just helping people. And so basically, you know, when the government came by and different levels said, what are you guys doing? You know, you really can't operate an Insight, you know, a safe injection site. And we said, well, no, we're not. We're just a medic tent helping people to make sure they don't die. We just can't sit there and allow people to die right in front of us. So we're doing something, right? So that was the situation we're in. And to be honest, it's actually, I would say, a more progressive model and less bureaucratic than Insight now. And people are really looking at our model as a leading model of just putting up a medic tent, maybe a trailer in an area where people are actually really overdosing in communities where there are issues. There's a lot to learn from what we have done. And we hire people from the community, you know, that are using the alley to help each other. So that's another thing that we do.
Well, there certainly are lots of things that have never actually been tried before, along with some things that are tried and true. Dr. Keith Ahmed, we actually decided to do today's program because here in the U.S. and in the Bay Area, we're facing a growing opioid crisis. And much as Sarah described, people are literally dying in the streets, and the number of overdoses are on the rise, and we've been reading about some innovative methods. What prompted the government of Canada to declare a public health emergency to tackle the issue? And what does that mean in the Canadian context? And what could it mean translated into U.S. cities?
Well, just to be clear, the Canadian government actually hasn't declared a public health emergency. It was the government of British Columbia that declared
just BC.
That.
Just
over a year ago, and I guess with the alarmingly high rate of death amongst very young people we were seeing in British Columbia in a way that we've never seen before. By the declaration of a public health emergency sort of allowed for two things. One, unfortunately, in Canada, we haven't had very good data collection to help us inform public health policy here. So by enacting the public health emergency in BC gave us a way to collect data much quicker to figure out who was at most risk of dying so that we could put measures in place to help stop and decrease the death rate. And I think it's a second important issue is that just by declaring a public health emergency, you're really letting the general public know that this is not a criminal justice issue. It's not a moral failing, that this really is indeed a health issue, and we really need all hands on deck here to turn the tides.
Well, some of the stats from Vancouver and BC, at least for so far this year, is the numbers actually show that things might actually be turning out worse. We just read some data released by the British Columbia Coroner's Office. 488 people have died of drug overdose just in the first few months of this year. And if it continues apace, it could be over 1,400 people before the end of the year. So what has the BC government done since that crisis was declared? And why are you seeing a rise in the number of deaths due to overdose?
I think it ultimately comes down to the toxic drug supply that's available here in North America. It's an unfortunate byproduct of the war on drugs and basic economics is currently the drug supply is in the hands of organized crime. And all the efforts that have been put around keeping heroin out of North America has led to organized crime groups looking for an easier way to traffic opioids around the world. And fentanyl is one way that they can certainly do that. And another reason they're looking to fentanyl, and now another more potent drug called carfentanyl, is that it's just basic economics. They're completely synthetic and don't need the poppy plant like heroin or morphine to be made, and they can be essentially synthesized in someone's bathtub. So with that increasingly toxic drug market, you're seeing alarming death rates. So I think we need to work towards two solutions. One would be the decriminalization of drugs to reduce the stigma associated with drug use, to get people out of using these drugs alone, like Sarah mentioned, and into more supervised areas and using drugs with other people, and really out-of-the-box thinking in how we can replace the drug supply and remove it from organized crime.
I think eventually there's not going to be a single person who doesn't know someone who's been impacted. Just personally, a childhood friend has a brother, 163 IQ, brilliant, mm-hmm. And just succumbed to medical issues brought on by drug addiction. The funeral's on Saturday. This is not a respecter of persons. Sarah, you yourself have had your own personal experience. How does that inform how you deal with this in the lives of others?
Well, you know, it's to be honest, you know, it's so horrible for us to be here, you know, watching people overdose again and again, and knowing that there are actually ways to actually put the brake on this crisis if we could get the, you know, federal government and the provincial government to really step up right now and do what's needed and really take it seriously as a health crisis. You know, I've seen many people that I know die around me. It's so traumatic for the downtown Eastside, the community of people who are already traumatized and have had very difficult lives, and then watching people overdose when we can be giving them medication that's safe, that, you know, that they won't die from using and getting it from the streets. There's so many different options that we could explore, but people are just very, I feel like people are just so behind the times, and they're not willing to try something new. They just want to go back to this, you know, war against drugs or situation that never worked. And I think that there's, you know, Keith has lots of solutions. We all have lots of solutions. All the experts know there's scientific proof that Insight saves lives. We've saved every life that's come through and overdosed. We don't want to see overdoses. I would like to be able to give people an alternative. You know, when they overdose and they have the drugs, and I'd like to be able to say when they've, after they've overdosed, these are your options. You can go to a clinic where you can get something that's not got that chemical that will kill you in it. It's a lot of, there's a lot of pain. There's a lot of people that have physical, mental trauma, mental health issues that have fallen through the cracks, ADHD. It happens because they have not had the proper treatment.
Well, talk about a bit what the storefront approach actually is. What does that mean?
The storefront approach in terms of...
Mm-hmm. To having people come in, it's an injection site where people,
okay,
you don't administer the drugs, but you allow people to come in, bring their own, and you provide hypodermic needles and alcohol pads and that sort of thing. Is that right?
Yeah, so we have a pop-up site. It's very, very simple, and it's in a crisis. It's actually just like, you know, an army-style medic tent where there's people that have Narcan training. Everybody's trained. There's nurses. We have doctors coming through. We train people in the community to take care of each other. And we avoid an awful lot of overdoses just because of that training that we provide. And the city's actually provided a lot of training as well. In a lot of ways, the government has stepped up, but there's a lot more to do. But, you know, we see up to 700 people a day, and we do our best to provide alternatives. It is very difficult to watch people overdose when we know that there could be, you know, a different option. It's such a traumatic experience every time it happens. We're so glad we're doing it, because so many more lives would have been lost had we not done what we're doing.
And
I think it's easy to do in San Francisco. If anyone's listening who's fed up with waiting for the bureaucracy, they can go to the, you know, big box store and get a tent, couple tables and a chair, and put it in a, you know, the community that's hardest hit, and just start letting people come and help them out. Get some Narcan, get some people trained in the neighborhood, and there you go. There's a medic tent, and you know, that'll save lives immediately.
Narcan, of course, is the emergency drug that's administered in the case of someone with an overdose, and a lot of ambulances now, and schools, and airports are now outfitted with these things. Dr. Keith Ahmed, how important is that sort of interventional approach?
It's crucial. From the data that we see in British Columbia, the vast majority of people that are dying are actually using drugs by themselves, alone, locked away in their room, mostly because of the stigma associated with ongoing drug use. And at Insight and at the pop-up supervised consumption sites like Sarah's, we have yet to see a fatality. And Insight's been running since 2003. We're very lucky with opioids in that we do have an instant antidote in Narcan, where we don't have that with other types of overdoses, like for alcohol. It's very, very clear that all these interventions that have been in place to really deal with the the toxic drug market and the bad drug supply are very effective at decreasing the mortality and the death rate. Just getting people outside of using drugs alone is really the big issue right now, into places where they can use in a much safer way.
To both
and
you
actually,
and,
another
go ahead.
Sorry, another big issue is that people not understanding that crystal meth and cocaine and all of those other drugs also have fentanyl in it. We did fentanyl testing, random testing, in a few days ago, just to learn how to do that, to test whether there's fentanyl in drugs, and it came out positive for everything. Everything came out 100% positive of the tests that we did. Everything had fentanyl in it. Meth, crack, cocaine, everything.
And why do you think that is?
Because they put it in everything. I think that, you know, I've always wondered, you know, why so much fentanyl, and I think mainly because it's easy to ship. It's cost effective and it's easy to ship, and it's easier for these people to make a lot of quick money. So, I mean, really what it comes down to is that. So, it's just crazy.
Well, you've certainly heard the critics who take issue with this approach, right? To set up a tent or open a storefront or a mobile van that allows people to come in and inject or to get prescription heroin and receive medical and mental health services. All of this implies some tacit ignoring or maybe even tacit approval of the behavior. How do you combat that critique? Sarah?
Well, you know what? These are people, they, you know, have had a lot of them. You know, I speak to people every day that are in addiction, and I've had issues myself. And I can tell you that a lot of folks have underlying issues of whether they're ADHD or they fell through the cracks or they've dealt with trauma or they're, in excruciating pain from cancer, or they got in a bad accident at work and then, you know, felt, you know, just ended up using opiates and then came off them and then started finding their own, or it wasn't working anymore for the pain. I mean, there's so many reasons that people end up using, and it's just, it's mainly health conditions, and it's a health issue, and we need to help these people with these health issues.
So people are dying of shame.
Them.
They're dying of shame in a way.
Yeah, I mean, people are dying that are our most vulnerable people in society. Mm-hmm. And that's all there is to it. And it's a health issue. And we need to treat it like a health issue, not, an issue where, you know, people are bad people. And because it's not like that at all. You know, anyone who spends any time, and it's not even a political issue. People are experiencing this. Like you said, you know, everybody knows someone who's had someone who's died. Everyone I speak to these days, you know, you ask a room of people and everybody puts their hand up because everyone knows someone who's died. It's a huge health crisis. It's just not the one that we thought was going to happen, but it is a huge health crisis. And it's happening to our most vulnerable people, people who slip through the cracks for one way or another. You know, they might have been depressed, you know, not knowing how to deal with it. The world is a tough place. It's a really tough place. It's hard to live in Vancouver. It's hard to live in San Francisco. It's too expensive. There's not a lot of hope. People live in bug-infested places. They live in absolute poverty. They have no money. They're in the streets. They're like that in San Francisco. I mean, they go through rehab, which is like 5 days long, and then they're back out in the street. With no home and no hope, and the dealers sort of sitting there waiting for them with, you know, fentanyl.
Mm.
And it's really difficult. And until we understand it, unless you've had mental health issues or you've had severe anxiety or any of these things that are very hard for people to live with, it's really impossible for people to truly understand addiction. And it's not, it's hard to explain to people, you know, but you have to be compassionate. We have to be compassionate for those who, you know, haven't got it aren't as privileged, I guess, in society.
It's impossible to describe addiction, I'm sure, to someone who isn't or has never experienced that. It's just impossible. Why not just stop? That's what someone says when they just can't imagine what it feels like to be driven to something that ultimately is deadly. We're hearing today from Sarah Blythe. She's the founder of the Overdose Prevention Society. And Dr. Keith Ahmed, he's a family physician and an addiction medicine clinician at St. Paul's Hospital in British Columbia. What are they doing right in Vancouver that we might be able to replicate in San Francisco and in cities across the country? We hope you'll join us. What do you think about how Vancouver is dealing with its drug crisis? And do you know someone who suffers from addiction? And what services have helped? Could this approach perhaps help someone you know, or maybe even you? We're going to take your calls right after a break.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark, or yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, this is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today. We're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And you can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. We love it when you have show ideas for us. You can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. Today, should San Francisco and other U.S. cities follow Vancouver, British Columbia's lead and provide IV injection sites as a way to deal with the growing opioid crisis? That's what we're talking about today. Tomorrow, while Donald Trump is tweeting and getting all the attention, members of his administration are busy reshaping everything from voting rights protection to health, safety, and environmental and banking laws. So, what are Trump's minions doing while we're watching the tweets? We hope you'll join that conversation. That's on the next Your Call when Rose Aguilar returns. Thanks a lot for being here today for a really critical conversation about what to do with the opioid crisis that's blooming right in our backyard. And in addition to Sarah Blythe, who founded the Overdose Prevention Society in Vancouver, and Dr. Keith Ahmed, a family physician and addiction medicine specialist in British Columbia, joining us now also is Dean Wilson. Dean is one of Canada's most prominent anti-drug advocates. He starred in the iconic documentary. It's called Fix, The Story of an Addicted City. It's a documentary film by Nettie Wilde, and it captured Wilson's own personal battles with addiction and his fight with City Hall to do something about the mounting number of drug deaths in the year 2002. It is now at least quadrupled since 2002. And since then, Wilson has dedicated his life to advocating for solutions for the drug crisis that continues to haunt Vancouver. So, Dean Wilson, thank you so much for joining our trio.
Good morning.
Yes, indeed. And by all means, we invite your questions at 866-798-8255. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So if you would, weigh in, Dean, on how your first-person experience informs your advocacy now.
Well, the one thing that got me started was we have a group here in Vancouver called the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, VANDU. It is a peer-run group. We became very political because so many people were dying back in the late 90s and early 2000s of HIV, and we thought that this is unacceptable. At that time, the overdose rates were very high, comparable to other places, but our HIV rates were comparable to sub-Saharan Africa, which was just totally unacceptable. unacceptable. Mm. So we started advocating for supervised injection sites and heroin maintenance trials. And we've worked very hard, and we've succeeded on both ends. I actually had to sue the government of Canada and the federal courts to legitimize supervised injection sites. And it was really funny back in, when we won this trial, my mother said that it would be even harder opening the second one. I said, no, it couldn't be, but she was right. But right now we have them open in about four or five cities, and they're opening up all across Canada. And I'm incredibly proud to be part of the whole system that is saying these are real people that shouldn't have to die just because they choose to use heroin instead of drinking a bottle of wine.
Mm. Well, San Francisco is trying to come up with a model similar to this. In April this year, San Francisco directed the Department of Public Health to convene what they call the Safe Injection Services Task Force. And the idea was to try to compile some recommendations about how the city should go forward with these sites. So what are the injection sites? How do they operate? Walk me inside, Sarah, if you would. Walk me inside and tell me what that experience sounds like.
Well, it's a different experience at InSite. It's ours is very, very just an extension of the alley where people are using, and it's just a safe place with people. It's a lot like Vandu has one too. The Vancouver Area Drug Users Network has one as well. And we have, we see up to 30 or 40 people at a time. And they come in, and we have peer workers, folks that are volunteers who, witness, people using. And if they overdose, everybody's trained in Narcan and rescue breathing. And normally, most of the time, at about 85%, we can get the person coming back before the paramedics actually even get there. So it's, you know, they come in. We have a greeter at the front. They come in from the alley. They sit down. We have a smoking area, which is very unique. It's probably the first one in Canada. I don't know, maybe Dean knows of another one, but we have a smoking area. Smoking people have been overdosing about at 50% of the rate. Mm. So there's definitely more need for that. That could be why more people are dying, is because they're smoking and there's nowhere for them to go. So we let people do any kind of drug that they want in any way, shape, or form that they want, and we witness that, and then they, they leave on, and then next people come in, and it can be 30 and 40 people at a time.
Well, San Francisco has safe injection exchanges, in other words, needle exchanges, but not these supervised sites. And so my guess is that these areas tend to be areas where there are already people who are using, and so the sites crop up where the need is. But I imagine there's also an issue of NIMBY, not in my backyard. I don't want it here. I don't want it anywhere near where I live or work or where my kid goes to school. So how do you deal with the NIMBY phenomenon?
Go ahead, Dean.
Okay, well, you know, we fought this in 2003 when we first set it up, InSight. And we're right squeezed between a tourist area called Gastown and another tourist area called Chinatown. And we're smack dab in the middle of it. And what happened was that we had all kinds of people against us. And about 5 years after the site opened, in fact, all those people are now with us, because it essentially took all the public disorder off the streets and put it into a medical facility. You know, another thing is, I just want to comment about your task force. They've got to make sure that they have active users on that task force. It is so imperative to make sure that those with a lived experience are part of the solution, because once we start feeling that people care about us, we start caring about ourselves. And that's another thing that happened. People now are actually engaging in medical health because of their entrance into the supervised injection sites. And I've even had people telling me that even not going into InSight, but going into the response centers, that they're also being directed to health, and they're starting to get involved in taking care of themselves. This is a phenomenal behavior change.
Dr. Ahmed, can we talk a bit, too, about The fentanyl issue, we touched on that just a bit. But I think once again, a lot of us have a mental picture of somebody tying off and shooting up in an alley, when in fact, the advent of fentanyl means that a housewife in the suburbs can have her fentanyl FedEx to her front door. That's how prolific it is. But it's also exponentially more dangerous. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think what we're actually seeing here is that there's a huge cohort of people that have become addicted to prescription medications. And as we're moving to an era where we're trying to decrease the supply, at the same time we decrease the supply, organized crime is coming in, and they're adding fentanyl, a really cheap alternative to look like oxycodone and to look like heroin. So I think what's happening is when people are turning to street drugs to look for the source of their opioids, like oxycodone, and they're actually getting a fake oxycodone from their drug dealer, it's laced with fentanyl. And because it's so lucrative for organized crime and easier for them to get it into the country. And there's many people that are not only injecting opioids, but are smoking it and snorting it. And even I've seen many patients that are still taking it by mouth, but no longer getting it from their physician in a prescribed way. And it's just so dangerous to turn to these illicit sources and these drugs that are masquerading as other prescription drugs. And it's just an era that we're entering now where the drug supply is very, very dangerous.
And it's about, 25 to 50 times more potent than heroin, right?
Yeah, but maybe 50 to 100 times.
Wow.
And there's another drug, an animal tranquilizer called carfentanil, that's probably 100 times. It's not even a medication that's been studied or is used for in humans in any medical way at all. But it's an opioid used to tranquilize large animals. And it's entering the drug supply here now. And as it's entered the drug supply, we've seen overdose deaths continue to just skyrocket. And so, I mean, ultimately, all these solutions, the harm reduction solutions, are very, very important. But we also have to find a way to change the drug supply, to change the stigma around substance use, and then to educate healthcare professionals to not only prevent addiction, but to recognize it and then treat it in an evidence-based way.
Well, speaking of overdoses, there have been 130 in the Bay Area just since 2015. So the numbers are increasing. But I've also noticed what appears to be a shift in how we are thinking about it. On TV, you see the guy in the scrubs with the stethoscope around his neck, and he's saying, you know, your insurance may cover treatment for this for addiction. And it doesn't seem to carry the same kind of stigma that it used to. But Dean, I'm wondering, Dean Wilson, you are on the ground there dealing with this. Are people still dealing with stigma? Are they still avoiding treatment and seeking help because of a stigma that's still attached?
Well, you know, we face stigma on a number of ways, so because of our addiction, because of our poverty, on a number of levels. But it is changing. It's changing for the better. And for those people who still think that we're something that we can be abused, you know what? Get over it. I can't believe the arrogance of somebody who goes home and has a couple fingers of scotch and yet says that anybody who tries smoking pot or snorting cocaine is some person that should be thrown in jail. What we're doing is criminalizing people that aren't criminals. And this is wrong. This is a health issue. And, you know, we don't tell people who are going to the hospital because they have lung cancer because they've smoked cigarettes all their life, hey, you're not allowed in this hospital because you did it to yourself. Of course not. We engage them in a health protocol and get them into some kind of therapy. My advice to everybody is when the drug supply is toxic, we've got to start regulating the supply. And that means we've got to register addicts and actually prescribe heroin, Dilaudid, whatever. And that's what we're doing up here in Vancouver. It's worked in Europe, and it's been working in Great Britain since the 1920s. We've got to get over the fact of the demonization of drugs. People want to change their moods. They're going to do it. In spite of putting us in jail, in spite of anything you throw at us, we're going to continue to do it.
from Dean Wilson, one of Canada's most prominent anti-drug advocates and a man who's had his own personal experiences. Dr. Ahmed, I'm wondering about the connection between depression, anxiety, mental illness, and what seems to be a skyrocketing increase in drug use. Are people, I mean, you know, here in the States, you know, we've done a few studies in the past seven, eight months or so, and there seems to be a lot of free-floating angst out there. And to what extent is there a direct correlation between things that people are dealing with in terms of anxiety, mental illness, and use of illicit drugs?
Yeah, well, mental illness itself is a huge risk factor for drug use, and I think what can confound that make it very difficult to treat is the manifestation of withdrawal and addiction is also looks like mental illness. But when we look at mental health as a bigger picture, including PTSD and a history of trauma, and those that are entrenched in addiction have such a severe history of trauma, both from before their substance use and from when they're entrenched in their addiction, and we have to look at ways to build a treatment system. What we're seeing up here in Vancouver and British Columbia is that this public health emergency has really pulled the curtain back to expose the fact that we really don't have a treatment system here in North America, and we really need to build this from ground up, which is what has been so difficult to respond quickly to this public health epidemic, is that healthcare has really ignored addiction for decades, and peer support has really filled in the gap, and to their credit, some of them are doing great work, and some of them are also not doing great evidence-based work, and healthcare really needs to come up to the table here. And I can tell you, through my 15 years of education, I got about 1 hour of education around addiction, and that has to stop. Healthcare providers and primary care really needs to step up to the table here, and we need to educate healthcare providers on how to treat, well, first of all, how to prevent addiction, and then to recognize it and treat it in an evidence-based way, in a comprehensive, holistic way.
It occurs to me, too, that tens of thousands of Americans are coming back from wars in Afghanistan and the Middle East in general, and it's literally showing up on the streets as addiction. I'm wondering if there are callers out there who have had their own experience and are wondering whether this approach could help. 866-798-8255 is the number. 866-798-8255, or drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to a caller, George in San Francisco. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, thank you for having me on. 30 years ago, we went to war. Our competition went into business. If we are to have any success, we have to disrupt the business model of the cartels. Interfering with their supply chain has been only served to push up the price. I'm happy to hear somebody mentioned that in Great Britain years ago, this is in the 1920s, as in Mexico, there was an effort to disrupt the supply for the cartels by putting out a better product at a much lower price. In Mexico, it was free, in exchange for total coming out of the closet, involving the family in the care program, and not trying to cure, but to manage the problem within a reasonable social setting. The clinics that we have for methadone are a good beginning, but they should be in every neighborhood. People should be registering openly with the family's awareness and come out of the closet and get a better, more stable, less dangerous product for essentially free. This would totally disrupt the cartel's business model, and we would have a great deal more success at a much lower price. That would mean providing maybe the heroin, but heroin is not a good idea. It's better with.
Okay, George. Actually, that was tremendously helpful insight, because we've been hearing about methadone clinics for decades. Dr. Ahmed, is there a difference between that approach that's decades old and this new approach?
Well, I think the approach that we're advocating here for in BC is a stepwise approach to treating addiction, where for sure. Methadone is one solution. Another medication you will have heard of is buprenorphine. And the science is kind of clear that those medications are the best tools that we have right now at treating opioid addiction, but they don't work for everybody. And for those people that they don't work for, we need to find other ways. In addition to that, your caller's point is, you know, treating addiction is certainly one part of the solution. Educating healthcare providers to prevent addiction is a big part of the solution. And then taking the drug supply out of the hands of organized crime. You can see what happened with prohibition of alcohol. The main consequence of opiate addiction is overdose and death in young people. And this can be avoided if we have a known drug supply that and known purity and known dose, like we do with when we're purchasing alcohol.
By the same token, I'm thinking I read an article where your mayor looked at the approach that you're taking with the clinics. And Sarah, he's saying that basically you're treading water. That's how he described it. That this is not progress so much as just keeping from going under in a tsunami of addiction. Is he right that this approach is basically just treading water?
It is. And, you know, honestly, we're ready tomorrow. I have a med management license. I've given, you know, I've worked in places where I've given out methadone in social housing and other medications. I feel that heroin or you know, other kinds of drugs, including marijuana, would be great to give to people that are just in such severe addiction that that's the only thing that works. Methadone works for some people. Suboxone works for some people. There's many different types of drugs, but we need to get people the medication that they'll actually take, and then we can start to figure out whether that's actually the medication that they need for their life. Maybe if they have mental health issues, there's something else there. But they need someone to, you know, they need to meet with someone on the front line, someone who cares about them, not a dealer who doesn't care if they live or die or anything. They're just caring about drugs. And, it, you know, it's just we've got to take it out of the hands of people who don't care about human, our most vulnerable people, and put it back in the hands of people who do care. And I'm willing to do that work tomorrow. We see up to 700 people a day. I would, you know, I could see myself giving alternatives to people all day long, just saying, hey, you brought in that. Let's test it for fentanyl. Oops, it's got lots of fentanyl. Let's see if we can get them taking an alternative. We do that. We do some of that with marijuana and another traditional medicine called kratom, which is actually really helpful to people. So we try and give the alternatives that we actually have at our fingertips, but we could use more. We really need to do more.
Well, if it's okay, what I'd like to do, because our own mayor here in San Francisco has come around a bit on this, Mayor Ed Lee has voiced his opposition to the idea at a panel on homelessness that was hosted by Seattle University earlier this year. He said, quote, we have a vigorous disagreement over allowing people to inject heroin and meth to literally destroy their bodies and their minds in a city-funded shelter, as some have proposed. However, he's kind of moving on this. He said, since then, he said that if medical professionals support the idea, in addition to the American Medical Association, there are endorsements by the AMA and others like the Harm Reduction Coalition and AIDS United. They've all advocated for these services. He said, well, if they feel this way, then maybe it is worth exploring. So in our final minutes, if you would, Dr. Keith Ahmad, would you give me your best argument for the city of San Francisco and other American cities to attempt the Vancouver model?
Well, I think we need to use science and data to inform public policy. And the data here is very clear that if you want to save lives and reduce the harms that are associated with drug use, you need to put in place interventions like supervised consumption sites. We've studied it. The chapter is closed. The book is closed. And if you want to see death rate plummet and HIV plummet and other public health important other public health outcomes, you need to put those interventions in and put them in a way that has been scientifically proven.
Dean Wilson, make your best case to San Francisco and other cities struggling with opioid addiction crises.
Well, what I say is everybody who's against them, get over it. It's going to happen. And if you don't do it in a medical facility, we're going to be doing it in the alleys. And in the words of Nancy Reagan, just say no to the war on drugs.
And finally, Sarah Blythe, would you give me your best case?
Well, you know, we see up to 700 people a day at our site, and we save lives every day. Those people would be dead had it not been for people in the community saving their lives, the heroes. I know one guy who saved over 340 lives, just himself. So it's just, it's unbelievable what we're going through, and it's only going to get worse, and you need to do something in San Francisco. You need to do something. And, you know, it can't be the war on drugs anymore. It never worked. And this is a health crisis. And if you don't do something, I encourage the folks in San Francisco to put up a tent and, you know, start helping people that way, and show that you can save lives and in an easy way, and care about people in the community, and do it yourself. Don't wait for the government. They won't shut you down because you're doing the right thing. And
right on, Sarah.
You just got to do it. Yeah.
Well,
so get out there and do it.
Well, all right, this is going to require a radical shift in a lot of people's thinking, but it's worth looking into. You're saving lives there in Vancouver, and we're so grateful to have your insights. Sarah Blythe, community organizer, founder of the Overdose Prevention Society, thank you so much for your firsthand approach to how to get out there and save lives in this epidemic. Dean Wilson, a prominent anti-drug advocate, and star of the iconic documentary Fix, the story of an addicted city. We are so grateful to you for sharing your personal story. Thank you very much for being here, even though you can only be here for part of the show.
Well, you can always invite us to San Francisco, and me and Dean will set up a tent.
Along with Dr. Keith Ahmed as well, who was the clinician who brought the professional approach to how to deal with this epidemic. Thank you, all three of you, and for the caller. Sorry we couldn't get to everyone, but we've been speaking today with three experts on the issue. You're going to be reading a lot more of it here in San Francisco. This has been Your Call. Yes, indeed, Your Call. It's produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Sana Saleem and Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for listening. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, in for Rose Aguilar. While Donald Trump's tweets get all the attention, his administration is busy reshaping U.S. health, safety, and environmental rules. The New York Times is running a series about this. Politico reports every week on five things Trump did while you weren't looking, from regulation rollbacks to losses in worker safety protection. What are the most important stories flying under the radar? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.